Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a lesson in history. How did American attitudes about slavery change during the 19th century? From the history books I read in school, it was always people of faith in the North, and almost all of those people, except for Frederick Douglass, were white. But was that actually the way it was? In fact, many of the voices that helped change those initial opinions were black, freedmen, and escaped slaves, who at great personal risk spoke out about the evils of slavery and helped change public opinion. But most of those voices have been lost in our retelling of history. But the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture has preserved those voices in their writings. My guest today is Michelle Commander, the Associate Director of the Center and Curator of the Lapidus Center for the Historical Analysis of Transnational Slavery. The center in total holds 11 million documents and items in its collection, and those accounts are at the heart of a new anthology, Unsung, Unheralded Narratives of American Slavery and Abolition, edited by Commander. The book demonstrates that black people, their voices, and their writings were an active participant in resisting slavery, shaping public opinion, and eventually securing their liberation. The name of the collection is Unsung. My guest today is Michelle Commander here on Studio Tulsa. Michelle Commander, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
For generations after the Civil War, the story history told of the abolition movement was really of a white Northern movement and Frederick Douglass. Thankfully, that is changing. And this book gives voice to a lot of blacks who are, as you write, agents and architects of their own lives and liberation. What did you want to accomplish with Unsung?
What I wanted to accomplish with this volume was to stress that enslaved people understood the stakes of their moment. They understood that they were going to need to kind of hunker down, to strategize with the folks who were with them there on the plantation, that there would need to be new ways of interacting with family members and chosen kin in order to survive. And so what I argue in the book is that it was the enslaved people's insurrection, their resistance, that really gave the momentum to the abolitionist cause, right? So you mentioned what was happening in the Northeast and Frederick Douglass, but there are also enslaved people and other folks who we don't always know their names who were also very active in the abolitionist movement.
Who are some of the voices all Americans should know from this period that we don't?
There are lots, but some of the ones that really stick out to me as especially special include Maria Stewart and David Walker. These are two individuals who are writing very early in the 19th century about slavery. They're writing about what it means to be an American. They're writing about Christian hypocrisy and slaveholding. They're writing in a way that is so direct, calling out names, calling out institutions, and so forth, that was very rare for their time. David Walker in particular writes in this way that you really feel the passion coming out from his pen. He's somebody who's writing a sentence and at the end you have four exclamation points. So even if you didn't get the thrust of what he's saying in the sentence, you know that he meant what he said. You go back and read it again. He used all caps in his text. It's really kind of a powerful text to just look at how impassioned he was about how black people were being treated in this country. So he's a free black man who's thinking about not only the future of black free people in this country, but also enslaved people. And one of the things that I think is really great about what he does, and it takes a brave person to write in this way back then, is that he resists this idea that somehow free black people should go back to Africa, which a lot of white politicians and even black abolitionists and so forth believed. They believed that they could set up a colony in West Africa and go back and perhaps have a better future. But David Walker had this really great quote that I hope I don't butcher right now, but he says something like this: America is more the black man than it is the white. We have enriched the soil with our blood and our tears. And he resisted this notion that somehow Black people needed to be put literally back on a ship and do a reverse middle passage to West Africa. And so this way that he's writing, the way he's calling out the hypocrisy of Christian slaveholders, the way that his partner, his confidant, his friend Maria Stewart as a woman is writing in this time is very direct, very rare, and very brave, because abolitionists, white and Black, every time they put themselves forward, they wrote a speech or an editorial with their name on it, that they gave a speech in person or agitated in person, they were putting their lives on the line. You know, they were often threatened, beaten, killed for their work. And for them to speak up in this way was very, very brave. And I think more people should know about the kinds of ways that people were philosophizing about America and what it meant to be an American.
And the two passages you use in this narrative are from like 1829 and 1835. This is right at the very beginnings of the abolitionist movement taking shape in America, and they're very much shaping that voice. I really found Maria Stewart's passage is really interesting. She's basically saying, you know, the unfriendly whites first drove the Native Americans from his much-loved home, then they stole our fathers from their dwellings and brought them hither. Mm-hmm. And she's laying this whole history out like Howard Zinn in 1830.
That's what struck me so much about it, too. There were these other sort of gems that I found in, like, the Anglo-African magazine, which refers, the Anglo part refers to the English language, but this magazine where you have people who are talking about white supremacy and Black futures before we talk about, like, white supremacist foundations of America in this contemporary moment, or Afrofuturism or futurist thought in this contemporary moment, you know. Sometimes people say nothing is new under the sun, and that's one of the things I sort of picked up this time around, sort of thinking about the archive and what slavery abolition looked like, is that a lot of what we say now in social movements was articulated way back in those moments that you mentioned, the 1820s and 1830s.
That essay was so powerful. It was written in 1860 from this magazine, and you know, I guess the writer wrote under a Greek pseudonym, but the name of the essay is "What Shall We Do About White People?" Which, yes. You know, how many articles were there probably in the white press? What shall we do about Black people? And they just turn this argument on its head, and they're talking about white privilege even among the most perhaps open-eyed whites of the time. This is they don't see their own prejudice. Even and it is a remarkable essay. What was your first reaction upon reading it?
I laughed in a way that was not ha ha funny, but it was just like one of those aha. You know, we talk about the Negro problem. You know, that really comes up in the 20th century where people are thinking about what are we to do with Black people, as you mentioned. But it's like, see, these people were on it. These are people who were thinking all the time. They were formally trained, or they were people who taught themselves, right? And they understood the kind of environment they were living in. And it just made me laugh that people were thinking in this way. And it's that same thing you mentioned about Maria Stewart, where you have these people kind of historicizing. That they're like, okay, this is what you say about Black people, but let me show you something about white people and the history of white people in this country and the ways that you need to change. And so it was just, in a way, it was kind of heartening to see further evidence that these people were asserting themselves. And even if someone was using a pseudonym or a pen name, that kind of sentiment was out there for folks to think and to further commit themselves to the abolitionist cause.
Were those voices in the wilderness for the most part, or was there an audience willing to hear these arguments being made?
I would say there was an audience for it, but there were also Black abolitionists who were a little bit more conservative, who thought, okay, well, we don't want to turn people off. We just got them on our side, and they want to help us fight against abolitionism. Let's not go too far in our, you know, kind of attack. Let's be more measured, or we can reveal our feelings about these things, or we can address this thing later. So it wasn't always the case that folks thought you should be that forthright in your opinion. And of course, there was racism within the abolitionist movement itself. So even if someone was anti-slavery. They thought that it was unchristian-like or that it was inhumane. They may not have been abolitionist-minded. And so an abolitionist is someone who's thinking, yes, I'm anti-slavery, I'm against slavery, but I also want there to be an immediate end to slavery, and I believe that Black people should have full rights. Not everybody who was anti-slavery felt that Black people deserved to have full rights that white people had either. And so there was some tension in the movement.
Oh no, without a doubt. And I would think even some who would claim the abolition mantle really didn't want equal rights. They just wanted a version of civil rights from the perspective of 19th century version of civil rights.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Are there essays that point out that tension within the movement?
I would say that if you go back and look at the David Walker, for sure you have some of that tension and the sort of the ways that he's calling out the hypocrisy. There's also some from, I'm looking through the book right now to make sure I say the name correctly, H. Ford Douglas. The title of his essay is I Do Not Believe in the Anti-Slavery of Abraham Lincoln, which is published in the Liberator newspaper. So there are some ways that even Abraham Lincoln, who is, you know, a beloved former president because of the Emancipation Proclamation, had some very not forward thinking yet, quite yet, views that he actually believed that repatriation would be a positive good, that he didn't know what to do with these free Black people. And I should note that the reason why a lot of white folks supported this idea of repatriation or colonization, sending Black people back to Africa, was that they felt that these abolitionists were troublemakers, that somehow these people who lived on plantations didn't know about their plight, and that it was the abolitionists who were causing the uprising or the discomfort and the upset. And it was like, you know, of course enslaved people knew what slavery was doing to themselves and to their family members and to their loved ones. And it wasn't the abolitionists who were necessarily rallying them to participate in some sort of insurrection.
My guest today is Michelle Commander. She's Associate Director and Curator at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, and she's the editor of Unsung, Unheralded Narratives of American Slavery and Abolition. It's published by Penguin Press. And actually, you begin the book with narratives that sort of point out this idea that all Blacks were aware of their condition and wanted to change their condition, but were, in fact, enslaved. And you begin the book with a series of narratives of uprisings and resistance that go way back into the colonial days of America. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to start the book with those narratives?
I wanted to give great evidence to show that it wasn't the 19th century. You know, they didn't take things for centuries and then decide to rebel. I wanted to show that early on, you had these kinds of insurrections. You had people who were inspired by what was happening in Virginia or in South Carolina as far as rebellion, even if these rebellions were stopped before they could really take shape. We know that even though we didn't have the same technology as we do, that enslaved people across the U.S. South and other territories, that they got news, they got wind of what was happening in Haiti, and they took some inspiration from what was happening in Haiti. The reason why they found out is because the white slaveholders in America were really afraid that the same thing could happen here. And so what happened when white slaveholders got more afraid is that they got more violent, and politicians moved to make even further restrictions on enslaved people. So that, you know, if before the Haitian Revolution or before some other insurrection that happened, someone from one plantation was given a pass to visit family members on a neighboring plantation on the weekend, that kind of thing was stopped. So people really kind of freaked out about the possibility for that same sort of thing happening. And they published these fears in newspapers. The enslaved people who worked in the home overheard people talking about it at dinner or breakfast, and they relayed those messages to the enslaved community, which again helped sort of gin up some of this energy about rebellion, even though they knew what their experiences were.
There's another essay in this collection by Eliza Potter, who was a mixed-race hairdresser who had sort of become a hairdresser to the fashionable. I guess she was a freed woman. And yes. You know, and the whole thing is, you're making this excellent point, is that as whites would talk among themselves with the hairdresser there, they, you know, it was like she was a lamp or a, you know, potted plant, and they would be completely candid about their fears. And she's mm-hmm. listening into the whole thing and writes about it.
Exactly. So, you know, they're just believing, like, oh, she's a great hairstylist. There's no way there's anything else going on in her mind. And, of course, this demonstrates the ways that you can just sort of spell out all of these things. And it's really funny when this, when that particular book is published, there's stories of these women sort of running to find a copy to see if they're mentioned within the text, because there's so much gossip that she's including. So there's like the average gossip about relationships and spouses who are not faithful and that kind of thing. But there's also insight into how these people who were slaveholders, not all of them were, but many of them were, how they talked about slavery. And also Eliza Potter's own feelings about slavery and her own sort of burgeoning abolitionism as well.
Another part of the book, which is some of the most touching essays, is from actually the narrative of slaves and fugitive escapees. Mm-hmm. And there are so many in there that, you know, Henry Brown, who basically brings himself to freedom by shipping himself from his plantation in a 3-foot by 2-foot box. What an amazing story.
Yeah, it is amazing. I want to see a new movie about Henry Brown, because he was, you know, very brave to do that kind of thing. He could have definitely passed away mailing himself in a crate, right, a wooden crate to freedom. But, you know, he worked with abolitionists, a multiracial group of abolitionists, to make it happen. And it worked out for him. But it shows, that story really shows the creativity and wit, the bravery of these people to realize a better life, right? So people who were separated from their family members, sometimes they thought that they would go ahead, they would go first, get themselves settled and somehow get news back to their family so that they could then run themselves. But Henry Boxer Brown is just such a fascinating story. And the images that various cartoonists of the time created about the fact of his escape are so fantastic. There's one where he's kind of popping out of the out of the crate, and you have the abolitionists who have opened it looking, you know, surprised and also wonder that he's actually made it.
There's another one that really touched my heart, and it was written in the late 1800s, 1889, I believe, is Bethany Veney. And it's called mm-hmm. The Narrative of Bethany Veney, a Slave Woman, in which she really talks about how she witnessed over the course of her life the sell-off of her entire family. Every one of her loved ones at one point or another, you know, were at the vagaries of the finances of the slave owner.
And, that's right.
And there was one point where she knew of another slave from the next landowner next door, and both slave owners were interested in them marrying. And what was really interesting was, you know, she wouldn't marry, you know, they said, well, how will we be married? And I think one of the slave owners says, look, if you love each other, then you just come together. And she goes, mm-hmm. no, I need a minister.
mm-hmm.
And so they find somebody who marries them. And she goes, I'm not going to say the part where I will forsake all others, because in fact I know that depending on your business next year, one of us could be sold. What an amazing opinion to express in this narrative.
Absolutely. So they knew that their experiences were inhumane. They knew that their experiences, the ways they were being treated, were against Christian doctrine that was used to sort of rationalize their slavery. They understood it. They had very good sense, right? And that's one of the things that I wanted to get across in this text, is that people are always thinking, they're always strategizing, they're always in conversation with one another in these communities, thinking through what it is that they're living in, right? So even to be someone who is used as a breeder on a plantation, or a man who is taken from plantation to plantation to impregnate women, it's inhumane. It is sexual assault in our current terminology. It was just a horrific time. Bethany Vinnie's case is quite rare toward the end of her life, where, of course, she's experienced a lot of atrocity and loss of her own. She's seen what's happened with other people who are part of her community. But after the Civil War, she is able to go back a few times to collect her family and to bring them to live with her in New England. So she does have a somewhat happy ending to her story, but a life of such despair and loss is, you know, almost too much to bear, right? It's almost too hard to read, right?
It is.
So to experience that, it's amazing that she was able to survive.
My guest today is Michelle Commander, an associate director and curator at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture and editor of Unsung, Unheralded Narratives of American Slavery and Abolition. It's published by Penguin, and it features a lot of different voices, narratives of slavery and fugitive escapes, poems, children's literature, and drama that were all some by freed people, some by escaped slaves, others by white abolitionists trying again to bring this cause to public attention. And I was really struck by the fact that there was children's literature. I didn't read a whole lot of it, but it's fascinating that this is a part of the story as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of my favorite parts of the book because it just shows you that people were thinking, where am I now? What are my skills? What is my skill set? How can I affect change? And the attention turned to the future. The attention turned to helping other parents be able to get to their children politically as Christians who held different kinds of views of how to assert their Christianity in the world before the world got to them. And so it's great to see these children's primers, these sort of ABCs of anti-slavery, these stories that really break down what slavery is like, stories that highlight the hypocrisy of Christians who hold slaves. It's amazing, again, to see that they were concerned and that they wanted to create this sort of anti-slavery future, and they were going to start in their own homes.
One of the most amazing stories that you tell in your short synopsis before each of these essays and excerpts is, it's common to so many of the people that are featured in this book, is that after slavery's end, during Reconstruction, you mentioned Bethany Vinnie, who went to the South, collected her family, and moved to the North. But so many of these people returned to the South, some from places they escaped from, to educate, set up schools, help this newly freed population participate in their society. That is so, I mean, can you imagine, coming back to this place where a crime was perpetrated on you and yet trying to set things right?
I often wonder what it is I would have done, or if our generation, past few generations, have it in us to have done something similar. It seems just so amazing that you could go through something that is so atrocious. I mean, unconscionable things you don't even want to dare to mention, things happened, and you go back into that belly of the beast, so to speak, knowing that while the institution itself has been defeated, the very people who enacted those laws and that violence are still around, yet you elect to help the Black people who remain there grow and learn and thrive. And you think outside of yourself. It's not just about your own bodily autonomy or your own sense of freedom, but you're thinking about a community of people. Is very powerful to me. It's very inspirational to me. I think the abolitionists of our time, the social justice workers, and the people who want to do right in our time could learn a lot from how these people, the enslaved people who were now free and the abolitionists who had moved on or who were, thinking about the disparities during Reconstruction and beyond, how they acted, how they saw it as their life's work is something for us all to sort of aspire to.
Indeed. I want to ask about the way you decided to close the book with a selection of advertisements that were printed 20 to 30 years after the end of the Civil War from freed slaves looking for relatives or friends who had been sold away, sometimes, you know, decades earlier. Why was it important for these ads to close the book?
I intentionally chose the ads that were published what seemed like so far away from slavery and so much of the way we think about the years and progress in America, at least. Of course, there were Lost Friends ads that were published 1860s to 1870s, but the ones from 1880s and 1890s really struck me, maybe emotional even, to see a man who could have been 50 or 60 years old who was still looking for his mama, who he was sold away from or she was sold away from her family, you know, many years before, or brothers and sisters who were looking for one another. I wanted to drive home the point that these were human beings, that they loved, they felt lost, and they still desired to reconstitute these familiar relationships, and they placed these ads. And we have some evidence that these ads that were published in the Southwestern Christian Advocate and other papers did indeed work. But for the most part, these families were never reunified. And, you know, it's very important to me as a curator and a scholar to get that point across, but also someone who is a descendant of enslaved people in South Carolina, where I grew up, it makes me understand how connected I am to other Black people in this country. I feel that connection based on similar ways that we live our lives, similar cultures that we have, but also in the sense that it could be the case that someone who's in Louisiana is literally a cousin of mine because of the devastation and the separations that occurred with slavery. It's very powerful to me. I wanted to include those as a kind of final note to make sure that we kind of lean in on how we understand the humanity of enslaved and formerly enslaved people.
The name of the book is Unsung. Michelle Commander, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michelle Commander is the Associate Director and Curator at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture and the editor of Unsung, Unheralded Narratives of American Slavery and Abolition. It's published by Penguin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. Please stay warm, be safe, and thank you so much for listening. I'm Rich Fisher.